It's the Security Weekly News, and it's episode 296. I'm Doug White, and welcome to the week of 7 May 2023. We've got poisonous parsley, ChatGPT, QR codes, BootGuard, Akira, wanted posters, SuperCare, VPNs, Jason Wood, and more on this edition of the Security Weekly News.
This is a Security Weekly production for security professionals by security professionals. Please visit securityweekly.com/subscribe to subscribe to all the shows on our network.
We interrupt our program to bring you this important message.
It's the show that keeps you up to date on the latest security news twice a week. Your trusted source for accurate security information and expert analysis. It's time for Security Weekly News.
Did you know that Active Directory is exploited in 9 out of 10 cyber attacks? With access to Active Directory, attackers can gain control of your network. To keep attackers out, you need to find and fix Active Directory security gaps. Meet Purple Knight, a free security assessment tool that scans your environment for hundreds of vulnerabilities and helps you fix the problems. Ready to reduce your Active Directory attack surface? Download Purple Knight, the number one Active Directory security vulnerability assessment tool. Visit securityweekly.com/Semperis, S-E-M-P-E-R-I-S, for more information.
Created in 2005 and hosted by security industry veterans, Paul Security Weekly is your source for in-depth coverage of the latest vulnerabilities, exploits, and security research. Our weekly security news discussion dives deep into the security issues we face today and potential solutions in a fun and lively atmosphere. Each week, we bring on guests from the security community to learn about their journey and discuss topics relevant to their work and research. You can also subscribe to our show by visiting securityweekly.com/subscribe or look for Paul Security Weekly in your favorite podcast catcher. We've recorded a ton of content over the years, so we created Spotify playlists featuring some of our favorite episodes, including interviews with Marcus Random, John McAfee, and Chris Roberts, to name a few. You can find them at securityweekly.com/starterpacks.
All right, welcome to Security Weekly News. I'm Doug White. Well, spring is springing. Allergy season is on us, and it'll be 40 degrees before you know it here in sunny New England. So, enjoy. Well, you know, I thought I would lead with this story because I actually think about this all the time because it happens all the time, and it's QR codes. And, you know, you go in a restaurant and they have a QR, or you get on the subway or anywhere else, and they have a QR code for the menu or for whatever, or the museum has a map. Anything you have, it's like, scan this and that kind of thing. I see these things constantly. You need to pay for parking, scan this code. It's stuck on a metal box on 51st Street or something. And, as you and I would probably guess, these things are easily abused. And I know all of us think that way constantly. That's why we work in this field, right? We're just generally paranoid. But apparently a woman in Singapore lost $20,000. And they didn't say if it was Singapore dollars or U.S. dollars, but whatever. But it's still a lot of money. And it was a QR scam at a bubble tea shop. So there was apparently a sticker on the door that said, fill out a survey and get a free cup of milk tea. Okay, well, I wouldn't do it because I don't like the idea of scanning codes off a wall, even for a free cup of tea. But a lot of people would. A lot of people would scan that. If it says free burrito, free time. Now, I don't know. If it said free burrito, I might scan it. But it is a free product. So what happened? Well, the link that she scanned downloaded a third-party app onto the Android phone she was using to complete the survey. Okay, again, that's kind of what you would expect to happen, right? They're not going to give you the free tea for nothing. So they're going to ask you to do something, complete a survey, watch a video, whatever. So, you say, okay. Well, it's how free product stuff always works, which is another reason I don't even like to do it if it's legit. But the app apparently remained running after she had installed it and done the survey to get the free tea, which I was wondering, was she suspicious when they didn't give her the free tea when she went? It didn't say if she actually got the free tea. But the app running actually managed to extract $20,000 from the person's bank account that night. So basically what happened was the app just took over the phone and monitored what was doing, because when you installed it, you said, okay. It took over the camera. It took over the clipboard. It took over everything on the phone. And so it was able to get, apparently, her credentials from where she used a banking app. And I guess she wasn't using multi-factor, or it would, I don't know, maybe it was able to do that too. Some of those things are really sophisticated. But there were other cases cited in the story where fake parking citations were being placed on cars in San Francisco that had a QR code to pay your fine. So it says, if you park in San Francisco or New York, I've never parked in San Francisco, but I parked in New York plenty. And I know, half the time you get a citation for some ridiculous nonsense like, one time I got a $500 citation in New York because when I parked the car, it was fine. Somebody came by and put a cone beside it later that they took a picture of and said it was illegally parked, and I got this big fine. Well, the parking citation is a pretty good scam. So the ticket example had the wrong date on the citation, but do you really read those things that closely? Consult your attorney. I mean, I think I'm one of the most wanted parking scofflaws in Paris. I don't even know how many citations I've had in Paris. But the ticket had a link with a QR code to a fake copy of the San Francisco Municipal Transportation Agency, and apparently just gets you to pay the $60 fine to the fake site. Pretty innovative. So you might want to remind people about how easy it is to put a QR sticker over another QR sticker in a restaurant menu, or just stick a QR code up on a wall outside of a restaurant or outside of a club or anything, or, just make a fake parking ticket with a printer and, boom, there you go. So it is a readable article for just about anybody. Well, Intel is investigating a leak of private keys, which are used by the Intel Boot Guard security feature. Now, if you aren't up on your boot up stuff, Boot Guard is an Intel feature that basically tries to prevent you from accidentally installing, or an automated process from accidentally installing, malicious UEFI firmware on, in this particular case, MSI devices. Now, the Boot Guard process works on any hardware, but this was about MSI. Now, you've probably heard Paul talk about this kind of stuff on Paul's Security Weekly, and there's plenty of episodes where they were talking about UEFI hacks and firmware hacks and all that kind of thing. But this is all part of Intel's hardware shield, which is called the hardware shield below the OS security package. And basically what Boot Guard does is it validates the source code for the UEFI before the CPU actually executes the initial boot block. So this is how computers start up. So you turn them on, and there's a reference point to the storage of the initial boot block, which is the part of the linked list that then loads all the instructions for the basic UEFI boot up of the system. And so if a UEFI tries to be loaded that's different from the one from a valid one, meaning the keys don't match or the certificates don't match, then basically that boot block process says, sorry, I can't load this, and it prevents you from accidentally loading these bootloader viruses. But in March, the Money Message Extortion Gang attacked MSI and claimed they stole 1.5 terabytes of data in the attack, which included firmware, source code, databases, and so forth. They immediately demanded a $4 million ransom from MSI, and MSI refused. So they began leaking the data on their leak site. Well, last week, they began leaking firmware source code for the MSI motherboards. Now, Binarly warned on Friday that this leak has the image signing private keys for 57 MSI products, and they went on and said that it had keys for Intel Boot Guard, including 116 other MSI products. Intel said they were aware of these reports and were actively investigating the matter. They did say that the Intel Boot Guard OEM keys are generated by the system manufacturer, and that the keys being found were not Intel signing keys, so they couldn't just sign anything and send it out. I mean, I guess they could try, but theoretically Boot Guard would still block that because they don't have the keys for, say, an Asus motherboard or something like that, maybe. Binarly said that the leak may affect MSI devices using the Tiger Lake, Adler Lake, and Raptor Lake CPUs. So that's pretty recent. Intel needs a new naming scheme, right? Maybe try like Ponds or Fins or Bogs or something for a while. How about Raptor Bog or something like that? But anyway, Binarly claims that this is a direct threat to MSI, but that it could conceivably affect the whole Intel ecosystem, which sounded a little hyperbolic to me. I'm not sure that if the keys are generated by the actual manufacturer, that it would actually compromise other manufacturers in the process, but they didn't have a lot of details about that. But it does allow an attacker to basically make a fake firmware update that is signed with the private and public keys that could be pushed out into the BIOS, and then that would load even though you have BootGuard on that MSI motherboard. UEFI boot kits are really hard to deal with because they're being loaded before the machine actually starts the operating system, which means that all the anti-malware stuff you have is not going to detect it. And then getting rid of it is not very easy because it's embedded in the system. There are ways to do it, but it's no longer something that's easy to talk, my dad through trying to reinstall a clean UEFI setup on the system, if it will even let you do that. So some of the UEFI malware will prevent you from, overwriting it and so forth. Binary's argument is that if all these keys are baked into Intel hardware, then they're not going to be able to fix this in any easy way, and the BootGuard feature would then not be safe any longer. There is a list of all the affected products attached to the article, so check it out. Akira is a new ransomware operation that started in March of this year and already claims to have conducted attacks on 16 different companies in various industries. The new operation is not apparently related to the old Akira ransomware that you probably heard of back in 2017. They said it didn't really seem to have anything to do with that. Is an Akira kind of dog? I think maybe. But anyway, Malware Hunter team shared a sample of the ransomware in this article. And basically, what it does is it deletes the shadow volume copies expected. It uses a PowerShell command to do that. No big surprise. Then it proceeds to encrypt a list of file extensions, which are your personal files. That it's got this big long text list of extensions. It skips files in the recycle bin, which I thought was interesting. It does skip like system volume info, Windows files, and all that kind of stuff, since you can just reinstall and replace those. And they're not very useful to the ransomware people. All the files then have .akira appended to their extensions. Now, Akira then uses Windows Restart Manager to make sure that even if you have open files, they get closed and then encrypted. Every single folder has a copy of Akira_readme.txt, which is the usual ransom letter telling you how great they are and how they don't mean any harm. They just want your money, blah, blah, blah. But it does imply that the data was exfiltrated because it promises they will sell your data on the dark web. And if whatever they've not sold, they will publish on their blog. A unique negotiation password is provided to every victim. And the negotiation site that you go to has a chat system 24/7 that you can put your password in, and then it allows you and encourages you to negotiate the ransom that you have to pay. It sure beats tossing $1 million off a bridge on the Pacific Coast Highway, but they probably have better customer service than a lot of companies as well, from what I can see. But Akira spreads laterally to other devices, again expected, and tries to obtain admin credentials. It did not say how they were doing that. I don't know if they're using Mimikatz or what, but they're using something to get admin credentials. Maybe they just try to find them or get people to type them in. It did not say. So, if they do that, then they can ransomware your entire network. Akira has leaked the data of 4 victims on their site so far. Their ransom demands have been from in between $200,000 to millions of dollars. They do say they will lower the ransom if you don't need a decryptor. Now, how much would you pay? If you just want to prevent them leaking your data, they will take a lower amount and not provide you with a decryptor key. It doesn't say how they initially infect the victims, but let me take a wild guess: phishing. So you should definitely be prepared. Somebody in your company may click that link right now while you're watching this newscast. Well, Aaron talked about this last Friday, but I thought it might be worth a re-mention. Google announced a new cybersecurity training program last week. This class they're offering apparently is a part of a new cybersecurity cert that they're providing in conjunction with the Grow with Google initiative that they have. According to info, it was built by Google experts and it's hosted by Coursera, has a 7-day free trial, and then it's $49 a month. I think that's a pretty good deal. And a lot of people who are trying to get into cybersecurity, this may be a place to start. I mean, there's obviously many different options you can pursue, including universities like mine. But that's a more expensive and longer process. As Aaron said, check out John Strand's anti-siphon courses as well. They're very reasonably priced. And in fact, they're a pay what you can site. The Google courses are self-paced. They said they run for 6 months or something. So I wasn't sure exactly what that meant when it said 6 months for 7 hours a day or something like that. So I don't know if they're like live and you log into them or whatnot. But you can watch Aaron do a more thorough job on last Friday's episode of the Security Weekly News, which was episode 295. Or you can just go to Google and check that out with the link that is on our site. Well, the United States put out a $10 million bounty. I'm like, what? I know they do this, but it's just like a $10 million bounty. Yeah. The bounty is on this Russian guy who has been, and you probably know this person, who's been operating Try2Check for about 18 years. And now, if you aren't familiar with Try2Check, it's a very, very well-known and infamous site that you can use to verify the validity of stolen credit card numbers and other data. Like bank account routing numbers and things like that. The man is named Dennis Kolkoff, and U.S. authorities said that the site has earned at least $18 million to date selling access to this verification process. Now, apparently, Try2Check is your one-stop reliable source for validating stolen credit card info and is used by all the big box crime stores on the dark web like Vault Market, Unixy, and Joker's Stash. Try2Check's domains were seized in the United States on the 3rd of May by the Secret Service and the Department of Justice. So they all flipped over to that message saying this domain has been seized. A warrant was issued for Mr. Kolkoff of Samara, Russia, by the Eastern District of New York. So that means there's a warrant out for your arrest. The Department of Justice then proceeded to issue the $10 million bounty. Instagram accounts showed Kolkoff in a Ferrari. There were pictures of his family and so forth. So all you need to do is go and get him in Russia to make a nice payday. That sounds a bit daunting to me, but I know some of you will be all over it. It did not say dead or alive, though, so I guess you'll have to actually bring him back on a plane. Like, make him sit in the middle seat, though. Like, don't forget. So this is, you know, hot tip. When you're taking a suspect on a plane, always fasten the handcuff to your right wrist so that you can sit on the aisle seat. Yeah. And make them sit in the middle. And that, you know, and maybe behind the person that's going to lay their seat back in your lap the minute the plane takes off. Remember those old Lufthansas where the seat literally, like, I remember staring at some guy's bald spot for like 9 hours one time. I kept sneezing and he got really upset. I was like, sorry, maybe raise your seat up halfway so I could actually use my tray table. But okay, whatever. I know it's a big thing. SuperCare is a home care service provider and reached a $2.25 million settlement with 318,379 patients who were impacted by a 2021 attack. So that's about $7 a person. No, wait. The law firm's going to get 33% of that settlement. So that's actually 4.73 cents per victim. There, that's, you know, considering that SuperCare's annual revenue is reported at about $314.9 million by some random website I found, a settlement of $2.25 million, that's a pretty good deal for them. I mean, it's about like one of those parking tickets I got in France, right? So, you know, I mean, it's not very much money if you consider. The settlement did require SuperCare to make enhancements to its cybersecurity and business model. They will also provide, wait for it, 1 year of free credit monitoring. I think my total count on that now is something like, you know, almost approaching infinity. But it says that patients who file a claim will receive a cash payment of $100, and a second tier of individuals may be able to claim up to $2,500 for out-of-pocket expenses tied to the incident. It basically used an example of, they probably had this in a lawsuit, 4 hours of your time at $25 per hour equals $100, which is how they came up with that. I'm not sure how this works, since if there's 318,379 victims, and if each one is eligible for $100, that's more like $31 million rather than $2.25 million. Even then, it's still not that much, like 10% of their annual revenue. But it's something seems strange with that report. The lawsuit said that SuperCare violated the FTC Act by failing to maintain reasonable and appropriate security for members' personal information, and that they violated HIPAA, because it is healthcare, by failing to timely notify, failing to protect against reasonably anticipated threats, and so forth, all the legal verbiage that you would expect. The hack occurred in July of 2021, and the attackers accessed the network and patient data, which included all sorts of personal information like dates of birth, insurance, your name, what kind of diagnostic data you had, so they probably know my cholesterol sucks. and that sort of thing, and other sensitive information. It was a whole collection of things, and not to mention like actual x-rays and MRIs and all kinds of stuff were obtained. Under the settlement, they will be required to conduct pen tests, risk assessments, and then apply security measures. So it's taking lawsuits to get people to actually do security hygiene. They must also replace their endpoint detection and response with a newer tool and so forth. So maybe some good will come of these things as we start to see more and more lawsuits like this, because basically companies are not going to fix these problems until it hurts. I'm telling you right now. I've worked with corporate for years. I've worked on boards and so forth. If you want me to be on your board, give me a call. But you know, basically, you're going to get pushback until such a thing happens that can be documented in court. That's my opinion. Well, this article is useful if you want to give it to your people or read it to your family. You know, I constantly tell people to use VPNs, and there's a lot of VPNs to choose from. I mean, so usually after I tell people to use VPNs, they immediately say, which one should I use? You know, like which VPN would you recommend? And since none of the VPN companies are paying me to recommend them, you know, I tell them what I actually think. So for all the VPNs out there, well, there's a lot about these that are scary. You don't know what you're getting. You know, the department says some, this article actually says some lame things like there was a surge in VPN interest due to Utah banning pornography. I'm like, really? Was there? But VPNs have a lot more importance than just hiding your porn viewing habits or getting around state law. I mean, I don't use it for pornography. I use it to prevent my ISP from collecting data about my browsing or how when I'm online and all this kind of stuff. Because, you know, my ISP can see everything on the connected stream on their end if I'm not using a VPN. I don't know that they're doing that. They say they don't. But, you know, I don't trust companies because they say stuff like that a lot until they get sued. But it is pretty valuable data that, you know, I just searched for how to make a pipe bomb followed by a recipe for gumbo. That was actually my search history. I was like, oh, really? I was making a forensic case. Just, you know, I swear I'm not the gumbo bomber, and nor am I the Illinois enema bandit or any of that kind of stuff, although that was in my search history too. If you don't know what that means, you don't know about Frank Zappa and all that. But anyway, even just searching for a VPN is difficult. There's a lot of bad ones. The article has some decent advice like free VPN. I don't think so. I agree. And proceeded to recommend some of the cheap ones like IVPN. I use Hide My Ass, which is great if you're not trying to do stuff like get around Netflix viewing restrictions, because it is so well known that Netflix blocks Hide My Ass VPN and won't even let you stream sometimes. But it does work great for all your legitimate use. Despite the article saying you may not need a VPN, I think you do. But it is a good user-friendly article that you are able to distribute. One of the very few pet cosmetic surgeons, he is in demand by all the stars. Whether Snoop's dog Hulez needs a nose job or Joe Biden's new pup needs lipo before the big show, he's the man you call if you have the big bucks. Please welcome Jason Wood.
Hey, everybody. Good to be back with y'all today. I was looking around at, you know, what to talk about today and thought that, you know, we have been covering ransomware on the show for years. It is just so widely prevalent. Yeah, I mean, Doug's already, but was just spending a bunch of time talking about it again. Just the fact that we keep finding these articles and bringing them up gives an idea of how prevalent this is. But quantifying the rate, you know, how much this is actually occurring can be kind of a difficult proposition, since nobody has a complete picture of everything that's occurring out there. SC Media just published an article last Friday titled Ransomware Watchers Are Finding Creative Ways to Track Attacks, basically trying to get around or deal with the fact that, you know, they only have their own view into ransomware attacks and what data they can extract from those, from the information sources they have. Now, I was particularly interested in this because I just came off about 2.5 years of working on a team that did this and reporting on ransomware activity. So, you know, I have my own observations, but, you know, before I guess I get into those, we'll talk about the article itself. Derek Johnson is the author of the article for SC Media, and he got right into it with his first paragraph, basically saying, you know, everybody has a general understanding that ransomware has gotten worse over the last 5 years, but no one knows exactly how bad it is. Public reporting is spotty because, you know, the victims aren't going to report on it. They're going to try and hide it, play it down. offer another year of free credit monitoring and hope the problem goes away, things like that. And even if things do get reported, it's, you know, the information that's available is very, it's all over the place. You know, there's no standardization in how this stuff gets reported, what data got collected, what data is being collected by the, being asked about by the reporting party, and how it gets talked about. That's just all over the place. So the article really gets into how are firms going about tracking this information, and what are they trying to do? Now, there are organizations, some of the organizations that have some of the richest data available to them are going to be firms that do incident response, and they cite Mandiant in particular. And you know, CrowdStrike, where I work, has the same kind of view into it. You get called in to do a breach response, and as a result, you collect a lot. You get very familiar with how these groups operate, and that caseload really drives that. It's a very useful source of information. However, it's restricted with all kinds of confidentiality requirements. So how do we track that? What information can we track? Where can we put it? Because, you know, you get stuff like an intrusion is under privilege or something, you know, legal privilege or whatever. So that can't be tracked the same way, or it has to be handled in particular ways. But still, you gather up all this information. As a result, you know, these firms are going out, and you see a lot of reports. Mandiant in particular is always releasing different reports on things that they observe, the tools that adversaries are using, how do they go about operating, and maybe what is the result of an intrusion, at least as much as they can say. Obviously, yeah, like I said, some difficulties around this. Confidentiality is a big one. Victims really don't like it if they're trying to... they don't want to be identified in a report and you know, have information clearly point back to them. And honestly, you know, I've seen some articles that seem to, you know, well, this is the way it's happening everywhere. And, you know, IR firms shouldn't say that, make a claim like that, because they only have a view into what, you know, their caseload is. So it's a good sample of what's going on, but it's hard to extrapolate that out to everywhere. Fortunately for us, for defenders out there, I mean, this is a useful source of information as to how, you know, what they can report on is a useful source of information as to how these adversaries are operating and how they like to get into our environments. Now, if you don't have that kind of access, what do you do instead? Well, they cite Recorded Future, as you know, how they're a threat intelligence company. They don't do incident response. So in their case, they have to go out and do a lot of work to gather information about what's, you know, from what's available online. And that can be news stories from various outlets, but also going through and tracking data leak sites and tracking the, you know, what's going on there. That may require some language skills as well. You know, if they, you get some of these firms that get into some of the other side of this, where not where they're leaking it, but you know, forums for selling access or services to enable criminal activity, you know, that possibly requires some language skills as well. And so, you know, that's a lot of work to go out and keep track of this. In fact, I think Recorded Future said they had a couple of interns that spend like 15 hours a week just constantly trolling the news and looking for signs of some kind of intrusion and documenting that. They have pointed out this is becoming a much more complicated and possibly worse situation, because in 2021 they had 40 different leak sites that they track, and that number has increased over 150 now. Now, some of that can be due to group splintering. You know, individuals were all involved in one group and that group broke apart and everybody hangs out their own shingle and does their own thing. But still, it makes it for a very, very difficult task to try and gather all this information up. And then you have the law enforcement side. Obviously, law enforcement is going to have their own insights into this as they respond to intrusions with the purpose of putting out an arrest warrant for somebody and perhaps a $10 million bounty, I think it was. And so, you know, Why is this happening? Why are we getting better, more information out of law enforcement? Well, they've made this more important to them. This is a higher priority mission. And so now they're doing more investigations and doing more work to try and disrupt these groups. And, you know, on the plus side, I guess, if they can get a hold of somebody and get them arrested and prosecuted, they have the ability of removing people from the pool, though that seems to be slower than more people are coming into it. And, you know, I've deserved none. It seems to me, as I'm looking through the news, I'm seeing an increase in rate around that. Now, one of the problems that we run into with law enforcement reporting this information, and the article gets into some complaints from the FBI, for example, about how they want to get the information pointed to them, reported to them directly, and everything they can. You know, they're after a criminal case, and that's a different priority than maybe a company who's just trying to recover. Finally, the article talks about cryptocurrency and how we've gotten better at tracking cryptocurrency transactions, and it's become easier to infer some data related to ransomware payouts. Interestingly, a firm named Chainalys, tech company names, reported in January that ransomware payouts dropped from $765.5 million in 2021 to $456.8 million in 2022. So that begs the question, why is that? Are people not paying out ransoms? Did we have a decrease? You know, did the Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine impact this? How did that pan out? There are a lot of questions about different things could impact the pace of this. Really, reporting on ransomware and any other kind of scam or intrusion campaign is a difficult proposition to take on. Something that I have experienced, right? You've got to basically curate the information sources that you have to get this data together. This may be as simple as, you know, using your incident response or threat hunting caseload, which, you know, may not be very as simple as it sounds, depending on how that information is collected internally or stored, or may get much more complex. Obviously, like the Recorded Future example of trying to track all of this stuff down in open source information. Once you get that a consistent flow of information, you still have to have a way of analyzing it, recording it in a way that allows you to ask more questions of it, spot trends, and hopefully report on it in a way that's meaningful to defenders and helps others better protect themselves. This is something that always has to be worked on because things are changing constantly, so that cannot stay static. So you're just constantly evolving. For example, you know, I worked at CrowdStrike. I work at CrowdStrike, and I was involved in writing three of the hunting reports, annual hunting reports that the company releases. And, you know, that was difficult for us because we were immersed in this data every single day, but you'd have to step back regularly and take time to analyze, hey, what's going on? Has anything changed? Start asking questions about that. You know, why did this happen? We're going to have an internal debate about what's the best way to report on this. How should we evolve and how we're reporting on what we're seeing, and make sure we're getting as much information to defenders as possible that'll be helpful to them so that they can try and spot this information, this type of intrusion in their environment. And, you know, then you just get the questions that have come up because of that. You know, why did this change at this point in time? What happened? Was it because of our caseload? Was it because of some change in behavior? You know, you've got a sample and you're just trying to work with that as best you could go. I could probably keep going on this for maybe another hour or so because it's just such a rich area of information with lots of work to do. The SE Media article really only scratches the surface of the work that's being done here and what it takes to track this type of activity. I think this is one of those areas where it's ripe for a lot more research and both into gathering the information, but how do we disseminate the information in a way that's meaningful to defenders as a whole and enabling people to keep these individuals out of their environments, keep them from having to pay a ransom or lose data or things like that. If this is something you're interested in digging into, this is worth checking out more because, again, like I said, there's a lot of information available to us, more than there used to be, but there's still just a ton more work to do. So go ahead and dig into that if that sounds interesting to you.
All right. Thank you, Jason. And finally, is ChatGPT even real? Well, according to this report, ChatGPT is certainly powered by machine learning, as we all know, but those systems have to be steered by human workers, and they aren't being paid very well. NBC News reported that OpenAI has been paying droves of U.S. contractors to assist with what's called data labeling. And if you aren't an ML person or you haven't taken a bunch of AI classes or whatever, you may not know that data labeling is basically part of the training process. So if you want to train, what was the app on Silicon Valley, a hot dog, not a hot dog? But, you know, basically somebody has to actually look, a human has to look at the pictures and say, that's a cat, that's a hot dog, that's a car. And, you know, and that the level of granularity in that process gets more and more the further you go down that road. So you basically have to have people to actually look at the data and say, well, that's a pear, or that peach could be a juicy fruit, but it could mean something else. I mean, that's how we all learn, right? I mean, my mother told me that parsley was poisonous so that we wouldn't eat it off the plate. I thought it was poisonous until one night when I was in high school, I saw someone eat some and was thinking, would they actually put a poisonous leaf on somebody's plate in a restaurant? I mean, she told me later when I was a grown-up that it was that she thought it was embarrassing that we were eating the garnishes. I kind of liked it, but you know, she's like, don't eat that, it's poison. But anyway, thanks, Mom, for my unhealthy fear of garnishes. Anyway, they are paying workers $15 an hour. Yeah, so that's like minimum wage here. But data labelers have to look at all the things and decide what they are and what categories to put them in, and you know, and so forth, in order to train the ML. I can only imagine the stuff they must be looking at. But basically, this is the basis of machine learning, and training is part of it. And considering that ChatGPT uses so much stuff, I would presume there's a lot of labeling needs every single day. You know, hey, ChatGPT, is parsley poisonous to humans? ChatGPT said, quote, no, parsley is generally not considered poisonous to humans. In fact, parsley is a popular herb used in many culinary dishes, and it's known for its nutritional value and health benefits, at least not according to Doug's mom. Thanks, Mom. Well, I'll be at the Palmer House in Chicago for the Millennium Alliance meeting on the 16th and 17th of this month. And I will be at the Green Cities Conference in Augsburg, Germany on the 20th through the 24th of June. So if you're going to be there, stop by. And that's the news. Thanks, Jason. And I will see you Friday.